Room docket number 48168. Here on behalf of Mr. Lujan, we just lost Mr. Beislein.
Whoops.
We'll hang out. Stop the timer. Back on the record in docket 48168, Lujan v. Hillbroom. Mr. Beislein is here on behalf of Mr. Lujan. Mr. Hickey is here on behalf of Mr. Hillbroom. Mr. Beislein, are you prepared to go forward with argument?
Yes, I am, Your Honor. Sorry about that. It warned me that it was being recorded and I went to hit, got it okay. And I think I was just a little bit too far to the left there. So
that's fine. Go ahead with your argument, sir.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, I am Arthur Beislein. I represent the plaintiff appellate, David Lujan. The story of Junior Hillbroom and David Lujan is fascinating, but the only real facts that are relevant to this appeal are that in April of 2018, in the middle of a lawsuit, Lujan was taking Hillbroom's deposition and he learned that Hillbroom owned a house in Bonner County, Idaho. In that deposition, it wasn't disclosed how title was held, how title was acquired, or anything of that nature, just that that's where he was living. And then sometime after that, Mr. Lujan obtained a $3 million plus judgment against Mr. Hillbroom. And then he brought that judgment to Idaho and properly authenticated it. And then having heard about this property and knowing the address, he ordered a litigation guarantee, which is where he discovered how Mr. Hillbroom had acquired title to this property, which was from what he thought at the time was the same trust that he had been working for, but what Mr. Hillbroom testified to in the actual litigation in this matter was that it was an entirely different trust that was set up at the same time that this trust Mr. Lujan was working for was incurring fees and costs for the benefit of Mr. Hillbroom's trust. And so after he obtained a litigation guarantee, he filed suit, you know, shortly thereafter, but it was definitely more than a year from April when he first learned that Mr. Hillbroom was living on a piece of property in Bonner County. So the Mr. Hillbroom brought a motion for summary judgment, arguing that the one-year limitation on this type of a fraudulent transfer case had expired, that Mr. Lujan should have discovered this transfer sooner than he did. And the district court agreed with him on the grounds that, basically based on a finding of fact, that Mr. Lujan easily could have conducted a thing called a name search. And the primary basis for this appeal is there's just nothing in the record that supports that finding of fact. There's nothing that explains what a name search is, how it works, how long it takes, what it would have revealed. And so that's the primary basis that the ruling of the district court should be reversed. She made a finding of fact that's not supported by anything in the record. And to the extent she relied on the notice provisions of the Idaho Code that say if it's recorded, then you know about it, that is never a defense to a cause for fraud, whether it be fraudulent transfer or outright fraud. And
Mr. Beislein?
Yes.
So just so I'm clear, the transfer that your client was seeking to void was the transfer of the property, the quitclaim deed, to Mr. Hillbroom personally. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Okay. And relative to that transfer, who is the debtor for purposes of the UVTA?
Well, the debtor would be it'd be Larry Hillbroom in his capacity as trustee for that trust. But as I point out in my brief, when my predecessor in this case wanted to do additional discovery, that was the first time he had ever heard that Junior had set up a different trust. So arguably the wrong trust in this case had been sued, because it appears that Mr. Hillbroom received it from a different trust. But that's why the court should have allowed some additional discovery before summary judgment, so we could have substituted in the correct trust at that point. And also, you know, in essence, traced where this money came from. And Mr. Hillbroom, I mean, in essence, was having it just, that gets really to my constructive trust argument and why she shouldn't have dismissed that claim.
I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Go ahead, Judge Lorella.
I just wanted to follow up quickly. You said the debtor is Larry Hillbroom as trustee of that trust, by which you mean the 2005 trust?
No, I'm sorry. Thank you. This is confusing. It would be him in his capacity as the trustee of the 1999 trust. That's who the judgment is against, is against him in that capacity.
Thank you.
So, Mr. Beislein, then I guess for common reference, I've been sort of thinking about it as the 99 trust and the 2005 trust, right? And if the suit is against Mr. Hillbroom as trustee of the 1999 trust, how is the quitclaim deed, how do we set that aside with the UVTA? Because the 2005 trust is not a debtor.
You couldn't, Your Honor. And that was the reason that we were requesting to do additional discovery, is because during the names of these two trusts, the 99 and the 2005 trust, are very, very similar. And so Mr. Lujan he didn't catch that they were different trusts. And I could see how he wouldn't, because the fact that they have slightly different names actually wouldn't impart knowledge that there were two different trusts. Mr. Hillbroom could have just changed the name of the initial trust. And, you know, and to this day, we have not seen anything to establish the existence of this other trust. So if other discovery would have been allowed to be conducted to run this down, I suspect what we will end up doing would be filing a fraudulent transfer action kind of up the chain from Mr. Lujan or Mr. Hillbroom to the 2005 trust. And I'm pretty sure we would have developed that the 2005 trust was funded from proceeds from the 1999 trust.
Mr. Beislein, if I could interrupt you for just one moment about, I understand your position is that Mr. Lujan did not know of the existence of the 2005 trust until later in the course of this action. Is that correct?
That's correct.
How do you reconcile that position with the paragraph in Mr. Lujan's complaint, and it's at page 11 of the record, and it is numbered Roman numeral 12, and it alleges that the trust that transferred the property to Mr. Hillbroom is dated May 14th, 2005, which is clearly not the 1999 trust.
I think because they read what was on the deed. I mean, I don't know why they pled that, but that's what he said, you know, in his affidavits in opposition to summary judgment. I think they just read it right off of the litigation guarantee.
But wouldn't that be some kind of indication that there's a different trust, that they have different dates?
Perhaps, yes. But when you amend a trust, you can amend it, you know, as of the date of 2005 or whatever other date, you know, that it was amended. So, and I've actually done that where a 99 or an old trust is being called the same name, but with a new date because its terms have been changed. And I don't know why, you know, nobody picked up on the fact that it said 2005 or 1999, but he said in his, you know, opposition to summary judgment that he didn't get that until Mr. Hillbroom said that in his affidavit.
Thank you.
And anything I don't touch on in my brief, I'm not waiving that. I think that the briefing is usually better than oral argument. I just would like to finish by touching on the constructive fraud claim, where the court said there's no evidence of anything fraudulent about what went on here. And I think that when you look at the fact that Mr. Hillbroom when he was a trustee of the 99 trust, then started a 2005 trust and was funding it at the same time that he was not paying his legal fees to Mr. Lujan in the 99 trust. I mean, I think that just smells of fraud. And I think that would be the exact kind of case where you'd want to impose a constructive trust on the proceeds of, I guess, the ill-gotten gains of Mr. Lujan or Mr. Hilbrum's conduct in creating a whole separate trust and funding it and keeping it secret from his attorney and other creditors. If there are no further questions, that would I've reserved the balance of my time.
Mr. Beislein, I do have one more question, and I'm hoping you can help me understand this. So if there is a requirement under the UVTA that the transfer has to be made by a debtor, before you can even think about setting it aside, whether it's fraudulent, if it has to be by a debtor, and you, if I'm understanding it, are conceding that the transfer was by the 2005 trust that was not a debtor, doesn't that dispose of this case? I mean, how do we get to any of the underlying claims if we don't have the correct debtor to begin with?
That would be the basis for the request that the district court be allowed, or we be allowed to conduct some discovery. Because if it's determined, which I'm almost 100% sure it will be, that the 2005 trust acquired this asset or any assets from the 99 trust, well, then that would be the initial fraudulent transfer that we would have to set aside. The transfer from the 2000 that would also render the 2005 trustee not a bona fide purchaser. And so you'd have to undo the first set of transactions from 99 trust to 2005 trust. And when that's undone, well, they didn't have anything to transfer to Junior Hilbrum anyway at that point. Does that answer your question?
Well, it does, except that I'm not clear where in the briefing I would look to find the argument that the district court erred in granting summary judgment because it didn't address the correct debtor. I guess I didn't see that in the briefing, so I'm wondering how we could set aside the summary judgment motion on that ground when it wasn't briefed.
Because I guess it wouldn't really have been briefed. It's contained in the portion of the brief that's referring to the district court's denial of our request to conduct additional discovery in light of what Mr. Hilbrum said about this 2005 trust. Because if she would have allowed that and we could have developed the information, we would have amended the complaint to include the proper real party and interest for the fraudulent transfer part. And we would have left the 2005 trustee in there because they would also be a real party in interest because they obtained the property from the 99 trust. So that's the only basis really to argue what I'm arguing now, is that that's what we could have developed had we been allowed to conduct discovery before the court ruled on summary judgment.
But isn't it a prerequisite that you state a viable claim for relief before you're entitled to discovery?
Yes, but I guess the argument would be that they didn't understand that, whether they should have or not, they didn't understand and that there was, that they had the wrong party until he said, this is a different trust. And so that at that point, you know, if you conduct discovery to determine how that 2005 trust obtained any trust during the time that the 99 trust was incurring fees to Mr. Lujan.
When you, Mr. Beislein, are talking about the transfer of property and tracing it back, I want to make sure I understand what you are referring to when you use the word property. You're not speaking of the real property in Boundary County, are you? Are you asserting in some way that that property was originally owned by the 1999 trust and then transferred to the 2005 trust and then transferred to Mr. Hilbrum individually? Or are you talking about money?
It could be either one. If the 99 trust transfers the amount of money required to purchase the property to the 2005 trust, that's a fraudulent transfer right there. It doesn't matter if it's real property or not. So if they obtained the money to buy the property by means of a fraudulent transfer, then you set aside that transfer.
But I just want to be clear, when you're talking about property, when you're in your argument, you're not just referring to the real property that is the subject of the transfer that you, the complaint actually tried to void.
Yes, and I don't know if the 99 trust bought the property and then transferred it to the 2005 trust, the real property, or if the 99 trust just provided the money. I mean, I do know that Junior Hillbroom was penniless before his father, who owned DHL, passed away. So, I mean, it's almost guaranteed that I'm going to discover that one way or the other, this money came from my client's efforts to the 99 trust, and the 99 trust then transferred it to the 2005 trust.
But the record is at least clear, is it not, that the property was purchased in Bonner County in 2006 by the 2005 trust?
Correct, yes. So yeah, most likely what I would discover is that the money that was used to do that was transferred from the 99 trust to the 2005 trust.
So the transfer you're trying to void isn't necessarily the transfer you're trying to void.
Correct. I mean, really, if you look at it, the real issue on the appeal is, should we have been allowed to develop the information we needed to make sure we have the correct defendant?
So could that be the only issue that we address?
Perhaps, yes, because I think your point's well taken that I don't have the right defendant. So, I mean, you can't, but I thought of that, but I thought, well, I should at least address what the court also said. But I think, yes, the primary issue is whether or not we should have been allowed to develop further information to make sure we do have the correct defendant.
And do you have any additional argument beyond what's in your brief on that point?
Nope, I do not.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Beislein. Mr. Hickey?
Good afternoon. May it please the court. My name is Josh Hickey. I represent.
You're frozen, Mr. Hickey, so we need you to start again.
I'm sorry. May it please the court. My name is Josh Hickey, and I represent the respondent and cross appellant in this matter, Junior Hillbroom. How's my connection now?
It's great.
Okay. I want to address the issue that was most discussed in Mr. Beislein's opening argument, whether the district court erred in denying his Rule 56 motion for additional time to conduct discovery. In analyzing that issue, I think it's important to consider the arguments that were being advanced by Mr. Lujan at the time he was advancing them. Simultaneous with his Rule 56D motion, he was arguing repeatedly and extensively that the facts in the record were sufficient to overcome Junior's motion for summary judgment. As I thoroughly discussed and cited in the respondent's reply brief, Mr. Lujan argued in his written opposition to summary judgment that the facts and evidence in the record demonstrated a genuine issue of material fact for trial as to all four of his causes of action. He advanced these same arguments at the summary judgment hearing, with the exception of the breach of contract claim, which was withdrawn at that hearing. Then, after the court ruled against him on all issues and dismissed the entire complaint, he moved the court for reconsideration of its summary judgment decision. He presented no new evidence or legal arguments. He did not renew or ask the court to reconsider the denial of his Rule 56D motion. This is further evidence that Mr. Lujan believed that the record at the time of the summary judgment hearing was sufficient to withstand Junior's summary judgment motion. By advancing these arguments before, during, and after summary judgment, he invited the district court to consider whether the evidence was in fact sufficient to withstand summary judgment. Now on appeal, he claims that the district court should have ignored these arguments, that the facts and evidence were sufficient to withstand summary judgment, and instead, the court should have given him more time to conduct discovery. Mr. Lujan can't have it both ways. You either have the facts at summary judgment or you don't. If you don't have the facts, Rule 56D can afford you relief if you show by affidavit or declaration that for specified reasons, you cannot present facts essential to justify your opposition. By arguing that the facts in the record were sufficient to withstand summary judgment on each and every issue, Mr. Lujan was essentially conceding that he had either presented facts essential to justify his opposition to summary judgment, or that the facts he lacked were not essential to justify his opposition. Either way, he invited the district court to rule on his argument that the facts and evidence in the record were sufficient to overcome summary judgment. When he did that, he lost his right to appeal the denial of his 56D motion as a consequence of the invited error doctrine. As stated by this court in the 1986 case of State v. Griffith, the invited error doctrine is well settled in Idaho. A party cannot request a particular ruling by the trial court and later argue on appeal that the ruling was erroneous. In this case, Mr. Lujan invited the court to rule on the merits of his opposition to summary judgment. He cannot argue in this appeal that because the district court took him up on that invitation and ruled on the merits of the summary judgment motion, that the denial of his Rule 56D motion was an abuse of discretion. The court should find that Mr. Lujan is estopped as a matter of law from asserting this issue on appeal.
Mr. Hickey, do you have any authority that says opponent of a motion for summary judgment can't both argue that there's a question of fact, or alternatively, I need to conduct some discoveries to develop the record more to respond? Is there authority out there that says you once you file opposition to a summary judgment, you're barred from seeking a motion for further discovery, or alternatively, you know, that you only get one of those options?
No, I don't have any authority for that position. I am basing this argument just on my reading of Rule 56D, which says if a non-movement shows by affidavit or declaration that for specified reasons, it cannot present facts essential to justify its opposition, the court may, and then the court has several options as to what it can do at that point. My argument is that if you're making the argument that the facts and records, or the facts and evidence in the record are sufficient to overcome summary judgment, then you can't simultaneously be arguing, meet the burden under Rule 56D that you lack facts essential to justify your opposition to summary judgment. I think that's not a permissible argument to make. I think that is inconsistent with the plain language of the rule.
Thank you.
So just so I'm understanding, Mr. Hickey, then under the language of the rule, if under 56D, if you're asking for 56D relief, it's because you are arguing that you cannot present facts essential to justify the opposition to summary judgment. And you can't argue that you don't have the facts at the same time that you are arguing you do have sufficient facts to overcome summary judgment.
That's essentially what I'm arguing, yes.
And your authority, as I understand it, is just the language of the rule.
Just the language of the rule. I was not able to find any specific case that had touched on this issue.
Okay, thank you.
And does that argument apply to all the claims? I mean, is it your position that Mr. Lujan said the facts were sufficient as to all claims?
Yes, I think when you look through the record, and I cited the relevant portions of the record, I think pretty thoroughly, Mr. Lujan, I believe, was making the argument throughout that for all four claims, and in his written opposition to summary judgment, at the summary judgment hearing, in his motion for reconsideration, and even in his briefing in this appeal, that the facts and evidence in the record were sufficient to withstand summary judgment.
I thought the only claims challenged on appeal were the constructive trust, and the other one just left.
The UVTA claim.
Yes, thank you. Yeah.
But that is, yes, my position that with respect to, I think, each of those issues, Mr. Lujan was making essentially that argument that summary judgment should not be granted because there's a genuine issue of material fact as to each issue in my complaint. So unless there are any other questions about the Rule 56D motion, I'll move on to, let's see. The constructive trust issue. Sorry, my notes are, lost them. The UVTA claim, sorry. On appeal, he asked the court to overturn the district court's dismissal of that issue because he claims there's no evidence to support the inference that Mr. Lujan could have discovered the transfer at issue by performing a name search of the Bonner County property records. This argument misstates the district court's decision and conflates an inference with a conclusion. In this case, the district court's conclusion, the end result of the logical process that the district court engaged in, was that Mr. Lujan reasonably could have discovered the transfer at issue by performing a name search. In order to reach that conclusion, the district court relied on two pieces of evidence. First, that Junior told Mr. Lujan he owned the subject property in April 2018 at the deposition. And two, the deed evidencing the transfer of the subject property was recorded in the records of Bonner County in 2008. From these two facts that were undisputed by either party at summary judgment, the court then inferred that had Mr. Lujan performed a name search of the property records at Junior's deposition, that search would have yielded a copy of the deed upon which he bases this UVTA claim. The inference drawn by the district court was reasonable and was supported by the undisputed facts in the record. Under Idaho law, it's not the role of an appellate court to substitute its own inferences for those of the district court if those inferences are reasonably supported by the record. And Mr. Lujan has shown no reason why the district court's inference should be disturbed on appeal. He flatly ignores the evidence the district court relied on in making its inference and says that there is no evidence supporting that inference, but simply saying a thing is so doesn't make it so. The district court's inferences are reasonably supported by the record, and the summary judgment dismissal of Mr. Lujan's UVTA claim should be affirmed. As to the constructive trust.
Mr. Heckey, does any of that matter if the appellant has conceded that the wrong trust was sued?
If yes, the appellant has conceded that the wrong trust was sued, then no, I don't think that matters. And I don't think that, I think it could matter for the constructive trust claim. And so unless there are any other questions on the UVTA claim, I'll move to that issue.
Go ahead.
So as to the constructive trust issue, all this court has to do to affirm the district court's summary judgment dismissal is to look at Mr. Lujan's response to summary judgment on this issue. My client raised a number of reasons why this claim should be dismissed on summary judgment. Primarily, but not exclusively, Junior argued that Mr. Lujan failed to allege or plead with the required level of specificity any of the required elements of a claim for fraud. In his responsive briefing, Mr. Lujan simply stated, the plaintiff herein has sufficiently pled through the pleadings the elements necessary to impose a constructive trust as an appropriate remedy herein. The district court didn't err in dismissing Mr. Lujan's constructive trust claim because in order to survive summary judgment, the non-moving party cannot simply rely on mere allegations in the pleadings, and that is exactly what happened here. The law says that the non-moving party does not provide, does not set forth an affidavit specific facts showing that there's a genuine issue for trial, then summary judgment shall be entered against that party. And again, that's what happened here. The district court found that aside from speculative, conclusory, and insufficiently particularized allegations of wrongdoing, Mr. Lujan's complaint failed to allege or support a single element of fraud. His reliance on the pleadings was improper, and it was, and not only was the district court correct in dismissing the constructive trust claim, under the case of Hopper versus Swinnerton that was cited in the respondent's brief, the district court was required to enter summary judgment against Mr. Lujan. Mr. Lujan argues in his opening brief that the creation of a second trust created an issue of fact as to whether a constructive trust should be imposed against the subject property. And he goes on to set forth the alleged facts that he claims support the imposition of a constructive trust, but none of these allegations are supported by a citation to the record. And in fact, none of these allegations were supported at the district court level. at summary judgment or afterwards by way of affidavit or declaration, deposition transcripts, or any other admissible evidence. His argument on appeal should be dismissed for the same reasons it was dismissed below. The claim lacks any evidentiary support. It's purely speculative and is impermissibly conclusory. For these reasons, if the court finds in my client's favor on these issues, the court should consider whether pursuant to Idaho Code 12-121, the three issues raised by Mr. Lujan on appeal collectively or individually were brought frivolously, unreasonably, or without foundation. It's my client's position that it was frivolous and unreasonable for Mr. Lujan to appeal the denial of the 56D motion when he was stopped from making such an appeal due to the fact that he expressly invited the district court to rule on the merits of his opposition to summary judgment. His argument that there's no evidence supporting the district court's inference relating to his UVTA claim lacks foundation due to the fact that the district court plainly referenced the evidence upon which it was basing its decision in its memorandum decision and in its decision denying Mr. Lujan's motion for reconsideration. And for the additional reason that was raised today, that perhaps the correct defendant wasn't named in the first place in this matter. Finally, his claim that the record showed a genuine issue of fact on the constructive trust claim is frivolous and lacks foundation because he presented no disputed issue of fact to the trial court and presented no citation to the record on appeal to support those arguments. Turning to my client's cross appeal, the court should find that the district court erred in denying my client's claim for fees under 12-121. It's my client's position in this appeal that the district court abused its discretion in denying fees to my client under 12-121. Specifically, my client argues that the district court did not appear to recognize that it had the discretion to apportion fees for individual claims that might otherwise qualify under 12-121. Additionally, my client argues that the district court abused its discretion by failing to act consistently with the legal standards available to it. In this matter, the district court denied fees entirely and refused to analyze whether fees should be apportioned to Junior for any of Lujan's individual causes of action. In the case of Fitzpatrick Trustees of Fitzpatrick Revocable Trust versus Kent, a Supreme Court decision announced in 2020, the court clarified that although a district court is not required to apportion fees, it is required to take a holistic view to determine whether the standard for an award of fees under 12-121 has been met. Under this more holistic view, courts are instructed to examine whether the non-prevailing party argued the issues in good faith or acted without a reasonable basis in fact or law. In Junior's motion for reconsideration, I presented the district court with this language from this Fitzpatrick case and specifically asked the district court to consider whether Mr. Lujan argued any of the issues in good faith or with a reasonable basis in fact or law. With regard to each issue, I presented the court with Idaho authority supporting an apportionment of fees in situations similar or identical to the situations and issues that were presented in this case. With respect to Mr. Lujan's breach of contract claim, I pointed out that he asserted this claim in his complaint under the causes of action section, and that he argued it should not be dismissed at summary judgment in his memorandum of law opposing summary judgment. Then at the summary judgment hearing, he withdrew this claim and stated that it was only included in the complaint for factual or background purposes. Junior argued that due to its presence in the causes of action section of the complaint, his written defense of the claim against summary judgment, the breach of contract claim was frivolous, unreasonable, and without foundation. However, the district court refused to rule on that argument. I pointed the court to case law, specifically the 2018 decision of the Petrus Family Trust, where the non-moving party acceded to the entry of summary judgment on one of its claims at the summary judgment hearing, and the district court decided to apportion fees to the moving party on that issue. That decision was affirmed, and the district court's reasoning in that case that the plaintiff has given the court no reason to believe that the claim was founded on anything, on much of anything but conjecture, was held by the Supreme Court to be a sufficient basis to apportion fees under 12-121. Junior argued that Lujan's breach of contract claim wasn't based on even as much as conjecture, and that the court should apportion fees to him that were incurred in the defense of the breach of contract claim, but that argument was ignored. Similarly, Junior argued that the court should apportion fees to him incurred in the defense of Lujan's constructive trust claim, We argued to the district court that the constructive trust claim should be dismissed on summary judgment because he failed to allege or support any element of his claim with the required level of specificity. The district court agreed with his argument and dismissed the constructive trust claim for his failure to allege a single element of fraud. When we moved the court to apportion fees on this issue, we pointed out that, like the non-moving party in the Petras case, it would be appropriate to award fees on this issue, apportion fees on this issue, because the claim was based on nothing more than conjecture. Furthermore, I argued that Mr. Lujan's failure to allege or support a single element of fraud necessary to support his claim was by definition a claim brought and pursued without foundation. And thus, fees were appropriate under 12.121. Nevertheless, the district court refused to consider this argument and simply denied Junior's request for fees. With respect to the claim for declaratory relief, we pointed out that Mr. Lujan's claim for declaratory relief was frivolous, unreasonable, and without foundation because there was no evidence that any of the judgment debtors owned real property.
Sorry, Mr. Hickey, you'd frozen there momentarily, but it wasn't long. You're okay. Sorry.
I was saying there was no basis in fact to seek a declaratory judgment establishing the priority of his default judgment. He had no priority. The judgment had not attached. The district court again refused to consider this argument or the case law that we provided supporting our position that an apportionment of fees for this claim would be appropriate. Finally, we argued that because Mr. Lujan's UVTA claim was premised on fraud and his inability to even allege a single element supporting such a claim in the context of the constructive trust issue demonstrated that the UVTA claim was likewise without foundation. Additionally, we pointed out that Lujan's opposition to summary judgment on this issue and his motion for reconsideration was premised on an unreasonable interpretation of plain language of the UVTA's statute of repose. Mr. Lujan argued repeatedly that his claim could not accrue until he obtained actual knowledge of the transfer, despite the fact that the plain language states that a claim can also accrue when the allegedly aggrieved party reasonably could have discovered the transfer. At no point did Mr. Lujan make a good faith attempt to argue why he could not have reasonably discovered the transfer after the April 2018 deposition. And again, the district court refused to consider or address these arguments. In spite of the Supreme Court's admonition that courts are instructed to examine whether the non-prevailing party argued the issues in good faith or acted without a reasonable basis in fact or law. Here, the district court refused to engage in that analysis on any of Mr. Lujan's claims and simply held that viewing the case as a whole, it was not left with the abiding belief that the case was brought or pursued frivolously, unreasonably, or without foundation. It was error for the court to refuse to consider whether Mr. Lujan argued these issues in good faith or acted without a reasonable basis in fact or law after having been presented with the facts and arguments supporting such a finding. Finally, we argued that the district court abused its discretion on this issue because it did not reach its decision by an exercise of reason, specifically because no reason supporting its decision was provided. In the Fitzpatrick matter, for example, the district court in that case declined to apportion attorney's fees to the prevailing party on issues that lacked a basis in fact or law because it found that the non-prevailing party's case centered around a good faith exception to the merger doctrine. In this case, the court declined to apportion fees to Junior, but unlike the district court in Fitzpatrick, it failed to give us a reason why. There's no because. As such, it's impossible to determine whether the district court reached its decision by an exercise of reason or whether the district court acted consistently with the legal standard available to it. Today, as pointed out in my briefing, it's no longer enough for the non-prevailing party to have raised a single legitimate issue in order to be immunized from attorney's fees under 12.121. Because the district court did not tell us which issues, if any, immunized Mr. Lujan from attorney's fees under 12.121, we cannot know whether the district court acted consistently with the legal standard available to it, and it was an abuse of discretion for the district court to deny fees in whole or in part to Junior under 12.121. Accordingly, for the reasons I've given you today and in my briefing, this court should reverse the district court's decision and find that the record shows that Mr. Lujan's claims in whole or in part were not made in good faith or with a reasonable basis in fact or law, and remand with instructions for the district court to make further findings in connection with the amount of fees to apportion to Junior for each issue, if any, or alternatively, with instructions for the district court to reconsider whether to apportion fees to Junior applying the correct legal standard. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Hickey. Mr. Beislein, do you wish to reply to any of the arguments about the UVTA issue and or to reply to the attorney's fees argument?
Yes, I do. First, I think we should, when Your Honor asked me, can the whole case be decided just on the summary judgment request for additional discovery? I said yes, but actually the answer is no, because the constructive trust claim, Junior Hillbroom is the correct defendant in that claim because he's the one who holds title to this property. And they said that there was no evidence of this other than relying on the pleadings. Well, Mr. Lujan incorporated the pleadings into his declaration. So that's sufficient to put that in front of the court. And on that claim, I think what maybe Mr. Hickey's confusing constructive fraud with a constructive trust. A constructive trust doesn't require fraud or anything else. It just requires a set of circumstances where it would be unfair for the person who holds title to keep holding title. And in this case, what was in front of the district court was that Mr. Hillbroom created a whole separate trust, funded it somehow during a time and didn't tell anybody he had done it during a time when a different trust, the 99 trust, was incurring millions in attorney's fees to Mr. Lujan. And to me, that it would be a perfect grounds to impose of a constructive trust on the property, especially it's not clear in this record when you know that Mr. Hillbroom didn't own anything before Mr. Lujan met him. So it wouldn't be fair that he gets to own this house because he was not paying the 99 trust bills, but was funding a 2005 trust. So constructive fraud is not an issue. Fraud's not really an issue in this case at all, because a fraudulent transfer case isn't a fraud case. You don't have to prove the elements of fraud. You have to make certain allegations about when transfers were made in relation to the net worth of the debtor and other certain issues. I mean, and so they call it fraudulent transfer, but it's not a fraud case. And a constructive trust case is not a fraud case either. So I just wanted to clarify that. And on the attorney's fees issue, the only things that were pled were a breach of contract, which if you look at the complaint, it's pretty clear that there's no allegation seeking any kind of an award for a breach of contract. So it seems pretty clear that even though it's stated that they don't ask for anything for it, so they don't really set forth a cause of action for breach of contract. The other one was a fraudulent transfer allegation, which involves basically a question of due diligence. You know, how soon should they have discovered this transfer? That's a question of fact, which it means you can't really award fees on that one. And then the constructive trust claim, well, that would also be a question of fact, is whether or not there is sufficient evidence to impose a constructive trust on this property. So other than the breach of contract claim, the other two claims involve questions of fact that the court ruled against Mr. Lujan on. So I don't think attorney's fees pursuant to 12.121 in any manner would be appropriate, especially because it was, you know, Mr. Hillbroom's decision to try to get a breach of contract claim dismissed without first clarifying whether there was even one there. And so I don't think any award of attorney's fees is appropriate. And again, I would just sum up with Mr. Hillbroom is the correct defendant for a constructive trust claim. And so I think that the UVT claims are gone, but because we don't have the right defendant. But I think if we get back in front of Judge Buchanan, we will discover who does need to be properly joined into this lawsuit so Mr. Lujan can get some satisfaction of his judgment. And unless there's any other questions, that I would conclude.
Thank you, Mr. Beislein. Mr. Hickey, you may reply to the attorney fees issue only.
Thank you, Your Honor. I guess the only thing I would need to respond to on that issue is just because an issue is a question of fact does not mean that a party is not entitled to fees under 12.121. This was a court trial, and in this case, the court was entitled to make findings of facts. It did that, and it found that for pretty much all of these issues, there was no facts or evidence supporting Mr. Lujan's claims. And the absence of any foundation supporting those claims entitles my client to at least have the court consider whether fees under 12.121 applied. And I don't think that the district court engaged in the appropriate analysis in denying my client's request for fees.
Thank you, Mr. Hickey. Court appreciates the briefing and the argument in this case. The case is now fully submitted and the court will take it under advisement and issue an opinion in due course. Court will be in recess until August 3rd. Thank you, everybody.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.